In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn into the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Verse 11. But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
It was March of 2020, and I was sitting on the couch watching for the first time ever Back to the Future. And my wife and girls were in Charleston, South Carolina on a girls' trip, and I got a phone call that said, "You won't guess what happened to your oldest." And the story at that point, because I didn't guess, I just waited for the story to start. And as the story started, it was told to me that my oldest, who at the time was 12, went running into the ocean because she was ready to have a little fun in the sun. And at that moment, my mother looked to the left and noticed that there was a somber group of people immediately to her left doing a very somber act, and that was spreading the ashes of their loved one. At that juncture, they motioned for my daughter to come out of the ocean as she was running headlong into their memorial, and she walked out of the water literally covered in gray and black ashes. So, where she was ready to get a little fun in the sun, she also met someone's grandfather in the most unfortunate of ways. And it was, so as I'm sitting there watching this very mediocre movie that I was told I have to watch, thinking, how in the world of all humans did my daughter go plunging into this body of water of all square feet of the ocean to steal this moment from them? And if you are wondering, what does my daughter's unfortunate swimming moment have to do with this text of scripture? Actually, everything. Ruth did not grow up thinking my story would be one where I am now going to be covered in the somber moments of somebody's, "I can't believe this just happened to me." So on one hand, you had a family that was mourning a really dark and hard moment. On the other hand, you have a young lady whose only thing on her mind is, "Let me get in the ocean," and they converge into one spot. And sometimes there is a type of suffering that is truly unavoidable. And some people lean into it and other people run away from it, and it tells the story of your life. So why Ruth today in May of 2025 in this church? Because I am convinced and compelled to believe that most, if not nearly everyone in our gathering, is stuck in the suburban story. Not the Jesus story that I'm going to introduce you to, but the suburban story. It goes in a loop and looks a little bit like this. The suburban story starts with personal accumulation. Get the house of your dream, the car of your dreams, the finances of your dreams. It's remarkably exhausting. So then there's personal exhaustion. You take a few days off, you go on a few trips, you jump in the few wrong bodies of waters when you're doing so. Then you go into a deep season of personal care where you're getting yourself rested so that you can do what? Write another chapter of personal accumulation. Most of it is centered around children. Childlike desires define most of it. Something I've always wanted, I'm going to pursue it till I get it, until that weird season that someone who looks like you shares your DNA strand, pops into the story, and that child is there, and then your world revolves around them for a little while, only for them one day to leave, and you say, well, now I want to do all the things I couldn't do while I was having children, back to my childlike desires, and then after I do that for a little while, I'm going to go help my children raise their children, and children are at the center of the story. And a lot of it honestly starts to feel like a game of The Sims, if you ever played one of those on the old school computer, where you work, all to get, little Rihanna quote right there, you work, and then one day you fall over exhausted, you rest for 10 minutes on the game, you get back up and get some more. But this story is not afforded to Ruth, but instead she's invited into the Jesus story. Verse 16. So keep in mind, Ruth is a Moabite woman. She would not have known the God of Israel, but she gets God in verse 16. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or return from the following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. The invitation today is not about meaning, and it's not about purpose, though I think you'll hear tones of that throughout the text today. The meaning is to get in the story where you get to know God a little more, and you get to walk with him a little closer. And throughout the testimony of Scripture, that comes one way, and that's walking through the suffering of another person. Now, what we define as a great life is accumulating great amounts of blank. So a great amount of money, a great amount of trips, a great amount of vehicles, a great amount of square footage, a great amount of likes, a great amount of followers. But the Christian life is not about being great. It's about leveraging the ordinary, not pursuing the spectacular. I don't think for a moment that Ruth thought, when I get married into this family, probably what's going to happen is I'm going to be in the Bible one day. She just does a really ordinary thing, and it's right in front of her face. At the same time, it probably doesn't feel like God, but sometimes right in the body of water that you're in called life, you're intersecting with a story that's bigger than yours. I'm convinced that we live in a way where we think life is like a column. This first graphic will show that. It's about accumulating and getting things up, and we would define this as a successful life. Things are continually moving up. A little dip there in 2014. But ultimately, we're trying to get more wealth, more friends, more assets, more health, more experience. And let me say, having more of these, there's nothing wrong. Defining this as a successful life is a deception. But what the scriptures show, as Ruth's columns continually fall and don't grow, is that you actually live what I'm going to call for this whole series a gradient life. A gradient life is when two stories are intersecting at one. So if the blue represents your plans in your life, and this line represents from birth to death, a successful life is when more of Jesus' story permeates your daily life. And that's the invitation. Now, I think the book of Ruth is best approached like a movie. So let's start with this, the plot. What happened? Three people died, but I'm going to argue with you the four people actually died. One of them's just hidden. So for you to understand this plot, let me take you through the situation, the settings, and the significance. The situation. So a broken world is breaking all around Naomi. This is what her family tree started out as. Naomi is married to her husband, and then she has two sons. Those two sons marry these two women. The yellow indicates that they are Israelites. The blue indicates that they are Moabites. So they're technically not even supposed to be married, but you know, I guess for them, love wins, whatever. And they are married, and this is their family tree. Things are going as good as they can in a famine, which is what's going on in the text. And then suddenly, the husband dies, the two boys die, and this is what Naomi's life looks like. She's now a widow with two daughter-in-laws that, according to her customs, really hold no connection to her, and they should just go back to her own life. So Naomi's story is one in which she's facing death all around her, she's in a famine, and she's in a foreign country. So tragedy strikes in many different ways, and I think we can all resonate with this statement. Suffering is a painful situation that creates painful situations. So the two boys, the husband dies, and now she's a widow. So she's going to have to live off of her sons for the rest of her life. She's in a foreign land, so she's going to suffer that consequence. So then she loses the boys, which creates more painful situations because she not only lost her boys, she's now lost her income, her place in society, and even the daughter-in-law she may or may not liked at this point in time. But we all know how suffering works, is it doesn't just happen. You lose your job and then the bills pile up. People walk out of your life and then the bitterness sets in. Loved ones pass away and the loss continues on. C.S. Lewis, in his book about grief, says grief is a long valley, a winding valley, where any bend may reveal a totally new landscape. So quite seriously, Naomi will spend the rest of her life seeing a new piece of territory that grief has touched. So now she has two daughter-in-laws, and according to the text that we just read in chapter 1, she tells Orpah, not Oprah, but Orpah, to go ahead and head home, tells Ruth to go ahead and head home. Maybe you can find you a new husband and you can get back on your feet and start living a normal life again. Naomi's an Israelite, so she is a foreigner, an immigrant in the land of Moab. She has broken the commandment in Judges 3, 12 through 14, which says that she should not have allowed her sons to marry these women anyways because they were not Israelites. So what this helps us understand with suffering is suffering is really complex. Some people would have thought she was cursed because she was marrying her sons off to these Moabites, but nowhere in the text does it make it sound like she's cursed. And she brought some of the famine's happening. They're dying. She technically did what she wasn't supposed to do. Suffering is remarkably complex. But the cumulative testimony of Scripture with suffering is when someone is suffering, people need proximity first and evaluation second. This is the whole teaching of the Good Samaritan. If you go evaluation first, then distance will always be second. So whatever decisions Naomi has made to this point, part has happened to her. Maybe she could have chose some things different, but that had nothing to do with her sons passing away and her husband. There's so many people in our world suffering. You don't have to. As believers, like, we've got to wrestle with suffering. Because you have issues, but then you have the person. And I don't want to make this a single issue thing, but if your view of the issue forces you into treating the person who's in need poorly, the issue's your idol, and you need to deal with it. Like, I have a belief about debt, and people can get into debt, but I don't ever want to look at a person who's about to lose their home and say, serves you right, brother. I want to still be a brother in this space, and for time constraints, we can't tease this out some more. We're going to see this in future weeks. But the Scriptures call us first to proximity to a suffering person. So that's the situation. The setting. This text takes place in a land called Moab. It's named after a really crazy story in the Bible, the son of Lot. They name him Moab. The way that Lot had this son was he got wasted, and when he was wasted, his daughters wanted to have a son with him to continue on the legacy, and that's what this land is. So this is despised land by the Israelites as well. Not to mention, the Scriptures also talk about a remarkably obese king named Eglon that was, in essence, oppressing the Israelite people for 18 years. So they're literally living in the land of a people group that oppressed their people. They hated them, and that's exactly where Naomi lives. So she is not just an immigrant. She is an immigrant in a land where she remarkably would be judged by her people for and probably isn't welcomed by the natives. This is the setting of her text. Now, the text says in the very beginning in verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled. This is the director of the text trying to tell you the setting of the movie. Israel is now in the promised land in the days when the judges ruled. This takes us back to the very page before this in the book of Judges, where we see when they are in the promised land, the metaphorical Eden for God's people, land with flowing with milk and honey, carbs and sweets are all happening right there, and it's a wonderful place to be. And that's where they are, and it didn't remedy all of their problems, because on one page to your left in the book of Ruth, you will see four times this phrase, there was no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So Ruth is living in a day, Naomi is living in a day, and Orpah is living in a day where two of them are in the land that they belong in, one of them is not in the land she belongs in, and everybody is just kind of doing what they want, even though God's people are where they were supposed to rule and reign, and they're bringing their own chaos with them. They did what was right in their own eyes. The same ancient problem has now manifested itself again in a modern way. The serpent's deception is still working. They're doing what's right in their own eyes. And what's happening? People are being hurt, injustice takes place, and a famine strikes. So for them, they're doing what's right in their own eyes, and it's not working. So what is apparently true to people is seemingly false in practice. So if this movie was a set, it is not a sunny day in a suburban neighborhood. There is suffering going on, and it's not really the best place to be, not to mention they're in a famine. So Naomi is living as an immigrant in a land with no food, and she's a widow. People would have assumed that she was cursed. So she returns to Judah to try and rebuild her life. She goes home. So this setting, chapter 1, reminds us that the story of redemption always begins with brokenness. That's how every story that God writes starts. Every Monday, I start next week's sermon with a blank sheet of paper. And on that blank sheet of paper, as the cursor is blinking on my screen and I cannot believe it's time to write another one again, the task remains the same. You start writing, and it needs to end as a redemptive story. And that's your story, and that's my story, and that's the story of Christ. It always starts with brokenness, with someone's addiction, with someone's loss, with someone making more money than they ever knew what to do with and feeling the same sense of insecurity that they felt when they didn't have any of it. That's where they all start. So what's the significance? This text points us back to Genesis 3. So in Genesis 3, the fall of man comes, and there's three things that happen with the fall of man. They say, God says to Adam, you will work the ground, you will toil, and you will have sweat on your forehead as you work. So when you go to work tomorrow morning, if you hate your job, thank you, Adam. This is kind of your fault. So you're going to work the ground and toil, and yet in Ruth we see famine. Then God says to the woman, you will have pain in childbearing. So there's going to be remarkable pain, and it's going to be hard to have that family. It's going to be painful. And then right into Genesis chapter 4, one of those brothers ends up taking the life of another. Death is in the story. So Ruth's story is a lot like Genesis 3. No food, no family, death everywhere. What the book of Ruth is a four-chapter installment of the story of all of the Bible, touching on various points, and we'll see this throughout the sermon. So you can go ahead and look at this where this book of Ruth just right now is going all throughout the whole scripture as a bigger story. Ruth is pointing us back to the book of Genesis when suffering and hardship covers the world. Ruth is pointing us back to the book of Judges where God's people have everything they could have asked for and still aren't happy. And the end of Ruth is going to point us back to the Gospels to say that it's Jesus that would answer all of what ails everyone in this text. So Ruth is not just a random Old Testament book that was dropped in because someone thought we needed a female lead somewhere in the Old Testament. Ruth is the book in Scripture that is showing the biblical story of Jesus over and over and over again. It's the same as a Marvel movie. It's the same movie over and over and over again. But the story of Jesus doesn't start out with the Tesseract. It starts out with the situation, which we've already reviewed, a setting, which we've already understood, and an introduction. An introduction to a person who is injected into the story to bring about the ultimate end to every Jesus story, and that is redemption. The ultimate introduction into situation and setting, the situation being suffering in this text, the setting being brokenness in this text, Ruth is interjected into the story to be the remedy for what's happened, even though she is also suffering from what's happened. And Ruth is going to point us to Jesus, and then Boaz in a little while later is going to point us to Jesus, because that's really the story of Jesus. What's the situation? Suffering. What's the setting? Brokenness. What happens? An introduction, and his name is Jesus, into the story. This is what happens in all of the New Testament letters of the early church. What's the situation? Suffering. What's the setting? Brokenness. What's the introduction? The local church shows up. What are they there for? Redemption. Matthew 10, 34 through 38, Jesus hits the nail on the head in saying, I'm looking for more people who will be introduced into hard stories, when he says, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray that there would be more harvesters, people who will be the introduction in the Jesus story. Situation, setting, introduction, redemption. Now, Ruth's story is pretty ordinary like ours, yet this story is in the Jesus story. How remarkable is this, that Ruth's act of what we'll see next week, hesed, kindness, is in the book. I don't know about you, if you've ever wanted to do something great with your life, you get in your 20s and you realize, wow, my life's going to be pretty ordinary. But you hold on to it for a little while longer, and then usually you really start moving on when your hair starts thinning. Maybe that was just me, but I think you're going to notice that about yourself as well. And all of the movies, when someone wants to do something great, The Greatest Showman, you want to do something great, you just got to look at the stars. Realize who you are, I think is the way the lyric says it. We've watched it a lot in our house, to be honest with you. But in the story of Ruth, we see that if you want into the Jesus story, you don't look to the stars, you look into the dirt. And you say, who are the people suffering around me? Because ultimately, I want to know this king more closely. And the only way to get to know this king more closely is to spend time with him. And I think Jesus made it pretty clear at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount where you could find him, with the suffering people. That's one of the things that I find so perplexing about this faith, is when we want to get closer to God, we close our door in silence, get books that people have read, turn on the music we love, and try and get closer to God through intellect, when the scriptures have shown, oh, you want to follow Jesus for 3 years in an internship? You can apply today. We're going to walk the streets of Jerusalem. We're going to spend a little time in Capernaum. We're going to jump around a few places, spend some time with some lepers probably for a couple of days. After we get done with the lepers, we'll probably jump over and hang out with some widows for a little while, make sure they're cared for. And if you really do want to follow me, crazy idea, we're actually going to go have lunch one day with a tax collector. Everyone's going to hate you for it, but you're going to be there with me. So if you want to follow me, don't meet me at the synagogue tomorrow morning. Don't meet me up in the stars. Meet me in the dirt. The Jesus story is beautifully ordinary, and it's unfolding everywhere around us. See, in the kingdom, the successful life is the one that gets into the Jesus story. Matthew 26 is this remarkable story where a woman has an alabaster jar of perfume, and she breaks it at the feet of Jesus, wipes his feet with her hair, anoints her feet. Everyone is looking around saying, she's in essence wasting her life. And Jesus says, everywhere the gospel will be preached, her name will be talked about. AKA, she's in the Jesus story now. And that's the successful life. Church, the situation and the setting are the same for us today. But do you see the significance? You, right now, are living in the Jesus story. So there's 5 main characters in this text. We're going to look at them a lot over the next few weeks. This week is an introduction to one really long sermon that's going to last for 4 weeks. A couple of months ago, I would have tried it all at one Sunday, but today we're just going to set a few things up. And if you're interested in me just keeping going, you can come grab lunch with me today, because I would love to continue. But the characters, who are the 5? The first one is Naomi. Naomi is the matriarch of this story. She loses her husband and her 2 boys. Verse 12, she makes it remarkably clear. She says, I have no hope. And honestly, she has no reason to have it. She's going to die a poor person, either as an immigrant in a land that she's not welcome in, or she's going to go home and everyone's going to think she's cursed. So one way or another, she has no hope. She's a tough person who's come to peace with the fact that this is the life she's going to live. Let's be honest for a second. If you met Naomi today, what kind of category would she fall in? As uncomfortable as it is to say, we'd probably call her a burden. She's not going to contribute to the local economy. She's probably not going to produce any good books. I don't know that she's going to get anything on Pinterest that she cooked one evening that everyone will start following. I doubt many young men were looking for her selfies for the remainder of her life. And honest to goodness, no one probably was going to want to know what her cookbook was. She was going to contribute nothing, but yet in this story, she matters to somebody. So for me, who judges everything based on efficiency, speed, and accomplishment, I've got to stare this in the face for a moment. What if the calling you've been waiting on has arrived on your doorstep dressed as a person in need? If Ruth wanted to get into the Bible, she could have tried a few different ways, but all she ended up doing was just looking at the person who was in front of her, not as a burden or as an interruption to her calendar. We have so mystified the idea of calling, and we keep waiting for some angel to say, here's why you're on earth every day, while Naomi is beating on your door every morning saying, will you open the door? Will you pick up, staring her right in the face? She is not going to help the GDP, and honestly, she's probably not going to do anything to make anyone proud of your neighborhood, but she is the invitation into the Jesus story. So Ruth is looking for Naomi, not the love of her life. Ruth is not looking for the boss that's going to give her the promotion. She is not looking for her friend group. She's looking for Naomi. John Mark Comer has a brilliant quote with the understanding of calling. Sometimes a calling is staring us in the face, and we just need to make eye contact. To make eye contact with the young man who needs someone to disciple him, to make eye contact with the young family that's not going to make it unless someone steps in soon, to make eye contact with a child that needs to be adopted, to make eye contact with someone whose addictions are like chains that are choking out the very essence of their life, just to make eye contact with them. Now, what if you're Naomi? What if you're sitting in this room today and you are the suffering one? Now, let's be honest. Her suffering is really bad. Verse 20, she says to her people, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt bitter with me. Sometimes suffering is so severe it becomes your identity and all you have is a lament. What if that's you? And maybe you're Naomi and you don't want help, just like she didn't in the text. But here's a key for you so that you don't feel the pressure of being Ruth. Suffering isn't keeping you from being in the Jesus story. Your suffering is where Jesus intends to write his story. Your life is the blank sheet of paper with which he is waiting for you to get the cursor on it so he can begin typing. But you have to be honest that you're suffering. Because how can Christ write a better story in your life when the sin that you're hiding, that you're suffering from, is stuffed so down in the story that no one would even know this is what you're suffering from? Or what if the suffering is you're not doing as well as Instagram would lead people to believe you're doing? Now, let me say this, because I think in our day we have to say this qualifier. You must decipher the difference between suffering and common hardship in order to mature, be faithful, or step into the Jesus story. Some of you aren't going to like this sentence I'm about to say, but no, I love you when I say it. That works with my daughters. It may not work with you, okay? And if it doesn't, I'll find a new one next week. Not being able to sleep a lot is not suffering. Not in all cases. Busyness is often a choice. And not all stress is suffering. So we as a people have got to take a step back sometimes and say, just because life is a little strained right now, doesn't mean I get to tap out of the game. So the second character, Boaz, We're not going to talk about him at all today. Just know he's the heartthrob of the text. So if you're trying to, you know, it's a love story. We're actually going to get a little romantic. I missed it in February, but it's a love story. We'll get to Boaz next week. And then characters 3 and 4, Orpah and Ruth. Two horrific names, man, in 2025. And I'm sorry if you were considering one of them. I have an Aunt Ruth. I don't have an Aunt Orpah. But anyways, all right, so there's two women. So today, if this text happens, I'm going to go ahead and let you know how this text works in 2025. Both people go and rebuild their life, and they say, I hate that for Naomi. I hope she turns out well. I'll like a couple of her posts on Facebook to let her know I'm thinking about her. So we are a remarkably individualistic group of people. So Orpah does the right thing for a little while, and then she eventually says, you know what, I've got to go take care of myself first. Ruth dies to her entire life. Everyone would choose to be Orpah. I gave her 2 months. You know how hard it was to hang out with that sad woman every day for 2 months? And honestly, I'm falling behind back home. Do you know the shows that are racking up in the queue right now? Now, I doubt these were the things on Orpah's mind, so I'm being a little facetious right now, and I apologize for that. But why would we not choose Ruth? I think if we were being honest, it's because we're so individualistic. So individualism is not a bad thing. Here's a spectrum of individualism. This is helpful for me. On one far end of this spectrum, you have community idolatry, where everything is about the community. So it doesn't matter if you're being abused, you got to do what's best for the community. That's not good. Then on the far right, you have what's best for me, radical individualism. I only do what's going to profit me and those that live in my home. That's not good either, and I'm going to show you why in a second. And then right in the middle, the sweet spot, is living for the sake of others. It's this idea that the Bible and the kingdom teaches that your needs matter to God, but no more than anyone else's. And your wants only start to matter as others' needs are met. And that's a lofty idea, one that I am not faithfully living into at all times, but that we should constantly say this is God's vision for a community, that every person's needs, whether they are in the text, in the land they belong in, or if they're not in the land they belong in, whether they are the widow or the newly married person who can contribute, everyone's needs matter. At a foundational level, and then as those needs are met, then we start getting to the wants. That's his vision, and it's lofty, I gotta tell you. I want to delete that out the sermon, but it's out in the ether right now. But that being said, Orpah still is a good person. She sticks by Naomi's side, and she's heartbroken. And let's be honest, she lost her husband. So she goes home, and she does what? You got to do what's best for you, right? And I understand that, but here's the flaw. Orpah was just a few decades away from being Naomi, a widow, despised for the land that she grew up in. Church, I want you to step back and think about this. If everyone does what's best for them, just know that there's coming a day where you will not be the center of that formula. So doing what's best for you and those who just live in your home will not work one day. And you're going to need someone to step outside of life for a second and do what Ruth did. She pledges her entire life to serve Naomi, verse 14. They lift up their voices and wept, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Ruth gave up her future, her self-interest, and her desires, all for Naomi. If you want in the Jesus story, you have to believe that what's best for you is to live for what's best for someone else. We were doing a 5K in our youth group to save time. Just believe me that I have a lot of hip problems that make 5Ks sound like kryptonite, and I am far from Superman, all right? So here I am, a big part of the youth group. I know I have to go to this 5K, but I know I also can't run, and it's going to hurt my hips real bad to be apart. And it dawns on me that a guy in my class that I developed a friendship with, Daniel Miner, was in a wheelchair. Now, I was applauded for doing something really kind, and that was offering to push him in the race. But the truth was I needed Daniel Miner as much as he needed me. So actually, what was best for Stephen Daniel Johnson was to give his race up to push this young man in a chair. And it wasn't nobility where I was thinking this would be a Christ-like thing to do. It was the only way I'm going to make it is this way. And that's how the church is meant to work. Is it actually what's best for you is what's best for someone else? And where do we see that illustrated in the Bible? I wish there was another text. Oh, Jesus Christ, what's best for me is actually what's best for you. So a cross really isn't going to add a lot to my portfolio. I'm kind of confident in my lordship already. But what's best for me is dying for Daniel. And what's best for me is making sure that the birds are cared for in the same way to care for Daniel. This is the entire gospel pouring itself into a moment, a situation of suffering, a setting of absolute total heartbreak, introduction of someone who says, what's best for me is what's best for someone else. Ruth's story is what works. Orpah's story makes sense. In verse 14, there is a word that says she clung to her. The word clung there is dabak. This is the same word in Genesis 2:24 when God says, Adam and Eve, you need to leave and cleave to one another. The word cleave, hold together with one another, is this idea that two people truly become one. And that's the same word that the director of this movie used for Ruth. So he is conjuring up images for the Jewish listeners that Ruth did not say, if you need something, let me know. She quite literally has married herself to Naomi's problems and called herself one. Naomi and I are one, and that is the hidden fourth death in the text. The husband dies, son one dies, son two dies, and Ruth dies in this text. Her desires, her future, everything she could have ever dreamed of dies in the text. And she becomes Naomi. And we're going to see next week, she actually gets a husband out of it, because it's almost like, what's that verse? Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and I will add all of these things unto you. Not that it's wrong to look for a spouse and a house and to look for that rhyme that's a rap kind, or to look for a car or bars, whatever it is that you're looking for. What the scriptures teaches is the way that you get those things is by laying your life down, trusting to the Father, and Him add those things unto you. Orpah went looking for them. God found Ruth, and she became Naomi. Frederick Buechner defines compassion this way. Compassion is the sometimes fatal capacity for feeling what it is like to live inside someone else's skin. It's the knowledge that there can never be any peace and joy for me until there's peace and joy finally for you too. Or put according to the director of this movie, until you debak, cling to someone else. In a world full of Orpahs, who in our church has the courage to be like Ruth? Now, I know what some of us are thinking, because I think it. I think sometimes when I'm preaching these sermons, I'm like, well, you sound like you got it together. I'm writing these sermons like, yeah, gosh, you know, I have to listen to this sermon like 20 times as I'm working on it. And I'm thinking like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? So here's what I think a lot of people are thinking. How can I do this at my stage of life? And I don't have an answer for you, but I will point back to Ruth. She saw being a widow as an opportunity to have nothing but time to care for Naomi. So how does your stage of life and your limitations become an opportunity for the Jesus story? Now, I know what most of you are also contemplating that has nothing to do with this sermon. Do you feel spiritually stagnant? Suffering with the same sins, making the same commitments over and over and over again, trying to get things stoked up with you and God once more. And you're hiding into your devotional life, which I think is great, and you say, I'm trying to find God all over again with worship music on the way to work, with scriptures in the morning. All of these are wonderful things, and I say this with all of the love in my heart. You're never going to have some fire rekindled or this new closeness with Christ if all of your life is just about adding and adding and adding more knowledge, more this. You're probably at a stage where it's time for you to, as I learned a lot this week, instead of focusing on adding, focus on multiplying. I want to grow closer to God. Well, then go be like Jesus to someone, and it will demand that he be who he is to you. I am convinced that some of you are trying to break through a spiritual glass ceiling, and you're not going to do it at a conference. You're going to do it in the dirt of someone else's suffering. You're going to look at someone, and you're going to say, you can move into my home. You're going to look at someone and say, the papers are filled out. You're part of my family. You're going to look at a young man or a young woman and say, you can have my Mondays and Tuesday mornings. And that's where you're going to experience, verse 16, the God of Israel all over again. Church, it's time for us to grow up. You keep working on your own problems, but sometimes the best that you can do to work on your own problems is to stare in the face of someone and see Jesus. Which brings the fifth character in the text. He's hidden in plain sight. God. Strangely missing from this text is any theological background about who God is. Really, he's only mentioned in Ruth chapter 1, verse 6 and 4:13. In this story, God hides in plain sight in the beautiful ordinary. We'll talk about that more next week. So, are your eyes open? I think there's three areas of repentance that you may have your eyes shut. First, are you trying to be great instead of be faithful? That'll mean your eyes are wide shut. Are you trying to be in control instead of be available? Eyes straight down. I'm trying to feel good now instead of live eternally good. Your perspective will be narrowed. If any of these three are how you're living, that I'm trying to do great things instead of just be faithful, you won't see the opportunities in front of your face that look like widows. Or secondly, if all you're trying to do is make sure your kids are in the right school and your home's in the right condition and your job's in the right place and your raise is coming at the right time, your eyes are going to be so focused down in front of you that you won't see the widow who's in the text. And I think the last one's pretty self-explanatory. So, Ruth's life was a gradient, and it changed everything. So the question that we will seek to answer for the remainder of our 3 weeks is, what beautiful things is God inviting you to join him in doing in your ordinary life? I like to think of this text like a movie. I don't know who you would cast for Ruth or Naomi, but the beautiful ordinary in front of you probably looks like the guy on the treadmill next to you that you're convinced is looking at your phone the entire time you're sending a text message. Or the beautiful ordinary probably looks like the nurse that just so happened to look like she was having the worst day ever when she was coming to see you. Or the beautiful ordinary looks like those people who share your DNA strand that are sitting in your home waiting for you to actually be a part of their life again. The beautiful ordinary looks like that crazy person in front of you at the post office, and maybe they look like your favorite actor, but it's not that they look that way, it's that they're the crazy person on that day. For some reason, this burden in front of me actually is the invitation into the Jesus story. So the two questions I want to ask yourself today is, who have you chosen to care for even no one would fault you for walking away? And secondly, who have you chosen to disciple even though no one would fault you for walking away? And when you can answer those two questions, you're in the Jesus story. Situation, setting, introduction, and chapter 4, redemption.